Okay. All right. Welcome, everybody. This is a special affiliates-only teleconference presented by the Spiritual Cinema Circle. My name is Arielle Ford, and today my very special guest is Neil Donald Walsh. Most of you know him as the best-selling author of the Conversations with God series, but those of you who don't know him, let me tell you just a little bit about his story. In 1992, his life was totally transformed when he fired off an angry letter to God, and he asked God, "What does it take to make life work?" And to his very great surprise, God answered. This dialogue lasted for over 3 years and became the internationally best-selling book series known as Conversations with God, which has spent years on the New York Times bestseller list. Now there's a movie based on his life. It's also called Conversations with God, and it's going to be our feature film in the February collection of the Spiritual Cinema Circle. I want to read you just a few of the glowing endorsements this film has received. Marianne Williamson says, "This movie is a marvelous illustration of how a life can transform from something so seemingly hopeless to something miraculously good." Deepak Chopra said, "It's an incredibly emotional journey." And my sister, Debbie Ford, said, "It brilliantly and poignantly illustrates how life's greatest gifts could arise in our darkest hours." Some of you know that Neil is the host of his radio show on the Sirius satellite radio station Lime, but today we're going to turn the tables on him, and I'm going to get to interview him. So we'll start right now. Neil, welcome.
Thank you very much, Arielle. It's lovely to be here.
Well, we're very excited to have you. We have hundreds of people on the call, and they sent in lots and lots of questions. So I think we'll just get started. The one question that came up, 50% of the questions
yeah,
that came
well,
in
yeah,
was...
Yes, no, maybe, perhaps, and sometimes.
That's it. People want to know, how do you know that you're talking to God?
Well, I was having fun with you there, but the answer...
I get it.
Yeah, the answer to the question is, I think it has to do with the quality of the experience and also the information. And if I could qualify that just briefly, the experience is one that really, I don't want to sound fluffy or airy-fairy here, but it really does take over my whole body. That is, I have a physical experience of complete peace, utter serenity. Often I feel as though I'm near tears of joy. My eyes tend to water up. And I just feel, I guess, healthier than I have ever felt before. It's just a feeling of well-being, really extraordinary well-being. And that's a felt sense of wholeness that I can't describe in words other than those that I've used. And that's number one. So that feeling, that physical sensation, if you please, is what comes over me. It many people feel something like that when they're meditating or have other kinds of transcendent experiences. And then the second way that I believe myself to know is by the quality of the information itself that's coming through. Very often, words will appear on the paper in front of me or on the computer screen. I do much work by computer now that I would never in a million years have said, never have thought of, or never have constructed in just that way. And by the way, I have these experiences not just when I'm writing my books, but often when I'm writing letters to someone, emails to people, my daily blog. It isn't just, oh, Neil's going to sit down now and write a section of his book or an article for his newsletter. But in fact, these kinds of transcendent moments occur. And the reason I brought that up is, Arielle, just the other day I was writing something for my blog. I have a daily blog, and I realized somewhere in the middle of this blog that I had really flown away almost, just gone to a different place, and that the result was evident in the blog content itself. The comments that I received afterward from readers of the blog were, wow, you know, unbelievable stuff. And as I reread the blog a few days later, I myself saw that it was kind of like unbelievable stuff. It was entirely different in tone and nuance from the blogs before and after it when I was in a different space. And it was very clear to me that at that point I had gotten in touch with that transcendent part of all of us where I experience what I have called my conversations with God. I hope that's a good answer. It's the only
that's
answer.
That's a great answer. I've never heard you actually describe it that way. So I know half the people out there are thinking, where can they find your blog?
Oh, well, it's just in an obvious place, actually. It would be at www.cwgblog.com. Pretty straightforward.
cwgblog.com. And that leads me right into the next question was, when you are hearing God's words, do they always appear perfectly without any need for editing?
Yes, they do. If I try to get in there and edit it, I almost always mess it up. I am one of the few writers, actually, in publishing today, whose work is very, very rarely edited. I think the only kind of editing that's ever been done on my work is if there's a typo, my fingers just don't work right on the original manuscript, or if it's in my dialogue, that is words that I am saying. That I've had a syntax problem, or maybe I went on too long, and the editor might think that the question might better be phrased with a few less words. But in the dialogue that has come through me, in the voice of God, if you please, those words have never been edited. As a matter of fact, they tell a joke over at the very first publishing house that produced this material, and the joke was that the publisher himself went out to the editor's offices where all the editors sit in their little cubicles, and he said, who would like to edit God? No one volunteered, and that was the end of that. So, in fact, the words that have appeared in the books are exactly as they came through the first time. The flow of the book itself is the way it came through me the first time. My books require very, very little editing, just for grammatical errors once in a while or typos that occur in my dialogue.
Oh, that's great. What is the next question you'd like to ask God?
They're very personal questions. I was going to say I kind of have stopped asking God questions of a universal nature. If I were to ask God a question today, it would be, what can I do next to become more of the person that I really want to be? What is it that I don't clearly understand yet about myself and about life that stops me from experiencing myself as the kind and warm and gentle, caring, loving person that I can be sometimes, but not all of the time? And what is blocking me from experiencing myself as that 24 hours a day? That would be, and then I guess the next question I'd ask is if there's a secret on how I can unload my feeling, the bad feelings I have about myself from time to time, what would that be? Those
and
are the questions.
And then, of course, you'd have to write another book because all of us want to know the answers to all of those questions.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the movie a little bit. What was it like to see your life portrayed on the big screen?
Well, Ariel, it was surreal. It was very surreal, if surreal could be modified by the word very. Surreal itself is a pretty big word. It was just otherworldly. I don't think that there are 7 people on the whole planet out of 6 billion who could walk into a movie theater tomorrow and see a motion picture of their life. It's just not something that happens very often to people. There probably aren't 150 in all of human history, and there probably aren't 7 or 10 people alive today who could have that experience. I'm not bragging about that. I just want people to understand it's beyond surreal. It goes past surreal, right straight to otherworldly, because there's I'm one in a billion people who've had that experience. And as I sat back in the theater and watched the movie, I realized that. It just struck me, my gosh. There are billions of people on this planet. There can't be 20 of us who could have this experience right now. And it was so strange, and I wept, and I was moved, and I was touched by the emotion of what was going on. I got caught up, interestingly enough, in the film, just as a viewer would. But now, then something else interesting happened. I found myself, first of all, I began watching my own reactions to the movie. And I thought, isn't this strange? I know the story. I know what's going to happen next. Why am I being so touched by this? And then I watched myself watching the other people in the theater as they reacted. And I watched my own reaction to their reaction. And then I had a third level experience, which was when I got up and, as we did the tour, we took the movie on tour for several weeks back in the fall to audiences around the country, and I watched myself as people asked me questions about the movie and talked to me about it, almost as if I was a third person, almost as if the story was about someone else. And so it's very, very strange, Ariel. I don't imagine I'll ever have an experience like this again, you know, for the rest of my life. Most unusual and very difficult to describe.
And I know a lot of people want to know, how true did the film stay to your story?
Very, very, very true. We would not allow. I want to say something here. The production company, the Spiritual Cinema Circle, which produced this film, the producer and director in person, in the person of Stephen Simon, and as well as the scriptwriter Eric Delabar, allowed me complete and total freedom. One would almost use the word power. That is, I had the power to delete, to say no to anything that was in the script. There were a couple of places where Eric, as a good screenwriter, did what movie people do sometimes and kind of like, I don't want to say exaggerated, but embellished an experience or two or a line here and there. I'll give you a typical example. One typical example. There's a scene in the movie where I lay down a tip for a waitress in a restaurant, and he had me put down in the film a $500 bill or five $100 bills. And he just did that. He just kind of embellished a little bit what happened. The truth is, I think I laid down about $100 or so, $250s as I recall, or maybe $350s, for a young college girl who I felt, you know, just told me a story, and I was touched deeply by her, and I happened to have the cash on me, and just on a whim, I did that. But he had it in the film, in the script as $500, and I just called him and I said, Eric, I called Steven and said, we can't do that. Oh, he said, it's going to be so dramatic, it's going to be so wonderful. I said, Eric, it didn't happen that way. I'm sorry, it just didn't happen, and we're not going to do that. We're not going to show me in a way that's not true. I've never given anybody a $500 tip for a cup of coffee. This was in a coffee shop in my life. I said, you know, let it be what it was. I gave her three $50 bills. And that was, and let it be what it was. Well, you know what? I watched the scene in the theater a million times now. I've seen the movie many times in front of audiences. And when they see the 350s go down, they're gasping that, you know, that on a whim someone would do that. It didn't have to be. The point is, it didn't have to be any more exaggerated than what actually happened in real life. And that's just a small example of how the film was made. There's nothing in that film that I allow to be exaggerated, because the story is, you know, strange enough, just the way it is.
And, you know, I've known you since, what, 1994, when the first edition came out, and I know along the way there have been other people who wanted to make this movie. You know, why Stephen Simon?
Well, because I trusted him, for the very reason I've just described. Stephen Simon is a person that I completely trust, artistically, philosophically, spiritually. Every Lee that there is how I trust him. And I knew that he and the company behind him, not to throw bouquets where they might obviously be thrown, but it's just simply true, Gay Hendricks and the other folks who are involved in the Spiritual Cinema Circle gave me their word. And I know them personally. These are people that I've known personally. And they gave me their word that there would be no violation of the spiritual content, no exaggeration of the facts of the matter, and that I would have complete and total artistic input and control over the project. And I believe that, although I didn't really need to exercise control very often. I can't think of four instances in the entire movie where I had to make a phone call and say, could we not do this, could we not do that. Because we told the story very directly, and Stephen Simon was committed to producing on film an accurate and non-exaggerated, non-Hollywoodized version of my life, which is exactly what he did.
Great. So for those of you on the line that haven't seen the movie yet, and I'm so excited you're going to see it in February, it really deals with Neil's true story of the time when he was homeless with a broken neck, living in a park, dumpster diving for tin cans to cash in for money to eat. Neil, how did you become homeless?
Well, I broke my neck in an automobile accident, and I couldn't work as a result of that, and I was out of work, and I couldn't. And then, as my neck began to partly heal, but I still had to wear, because I had to wear a what's known as a Philadelphia collar, which kept my head up because my neck could not support the weight of my head. By the way, I must say I was very lucky. I mean, people who break their neck very, very often die or become paralyzed in some way or another, if not completely paralyzed from the neck down. It's just remarkable that I did neither. And I do have some range of motion difficulties with my neck to this day, but certainly nothing that would be anything more than a small annoyance. So I got out of that unscathed, but it took about a year and a half or two to heal from that broken neck. And during that time, I was wearing this collar, which supported the weight of my head, because my neck, of course, could not do so until it was totally healed and fused again. And so I was out of work, and I couldn't get work. I mean, I went everywhere to try to find work, and it was just not possible to do. And I finally just ran out of money. And I fell through the cracks in the safety net that is our system in our society, and there was no support for me, and I couldn't find work anywhere. I was really willing at that point to do almost anything, but I no one would hire me. And the film vividly depicts that. I walked the streets, really, and just begged even store owners, could I just clean the shelves or mop the floors or some light work that won't hurt my neck? I mean, could I just, you know, what, be a cashier, anything, I'll do anything. And no one wanted to take a chance on me because they saw that collar around my neck, and they just weren't about to hire a person who was walking around with that kind of contraption on him for obvious reasons, insurance reasons, and so the slightest move and they could be in trouble. So
right. Well,
I wound up on the street because I, you know, there was nowhere else to go. I ran out of money and no one would take me in, and that was the end of that story.
So did God ever tell you specifically how to change your situation from homelessness to where you are now?
No, not specifically. Nobody said, you know, what you need to do is, you know, take the following four steps. No, the advice was far more general, or the insight was far more general. You can be what you wish to be. You can do what you would choose to do. Don't worry about making a living. Worry about making a life. The kinds of freeing, actually the truth is freeing statements, I was going to say, the kinds of statements that free you up from your preconceived notions of life and how it works. The actual fact of the matter is that I did not have my conversation with God until I got off the street.
Uh-huh.
I got off the street before I had the conversation. It wasn't like, oh, this extraordinary experience, and then I wound up leaving the street. It was the other way around. I left the street, pulled myself up, if you please, by my own bootstraps, and then I hit the basement, because I got back into real life, got a regular job. I wasn't making a lot of money, but enough to survive, enough to be off the street. And then I really hit rock bottom, because I realized, my gosh, life really is empty. It really is shallow. It is offering me nothing here. And at that point, I just didn't know where to turn mentally. I thought, what is the point? And I was really kind of desperate. And you know, what does it take to make life work was the question that was plaguing my soul. And that's when I had my conversation with God, after I got back off the street and was into the mainstream once again.
One of our listeners wrote in and wants to ask you, he says, as a person who was homeless as a youngster, one of my greatest fears is to be homeless again. Now
yeah.
that I believe in the law of attraction, won't my fear tend to manifest me being homeless again? How can I correct that?
Well, not unless you dwell on it. I think the universe, you know, Mother Nature knows what's going on. I mean, the universe is really clear what you want and what you don't want. And if a fear just happens to fly through you, even if it does it once a week or something, I mean, but if you keep on just rejecting when it comes up, just rejecting it, just say to yourself, in a sense, no, I don't choose that. I don't want that. Thank you very much for showing me the opposite, but that's not what I choose. And then begin to rearrange your thoughts. Just think of something else and change your mind around that every time that thought and that fear comes up. And it will come up, because it's like trying to not think of the pink elephant in the living room. Of course you will, especially if you've had that experience in your life. I, too, have had nights or moments when I've rolled around walked down the street and thought of, oh, my gosh, you know, what would happen if I wind up back there again? And on the street. But I when I have those kinds of thoughts, I just kind of brush them aside. Thank you very much for showing me that, and choose again. And I think that the fact that I just have the thought is not what creates my reality. But if I dwell in it, if I have it over and over again, if I go there deliberately and with intention, see, here's what I want to say to that person. It's intentioned thought as opposed to a passing thought. It's intentioned thought, not even a fear, because fear is not an intentioned thought. The difference between fear and creative thought is that fear does not have the power of intention behind it. I want to say that again because that's very important. The difference between fear and a creative thought is that fear does not have intention behind it. If you intend what you are fearing, you will increase the power of your thought by 100 times, and you're very liable to draw that to you. But if you just have a passing fearful thought, hey, don't worry about that, otherwise you'll be afraid to think anything, and you'll just paralyze yourself mentally. Can't be done that way. Trust God. God knows what it is you really want. And God's not going to say, oh, he had a thought at 4 o'clock Saturday afternoon, we're going to give him that.
That's such a great distinction. So I see sometimes when I have what I call negative thoughts, I'll immediately say to myself, cancel, cancel. Do you think that's a good idea?
It doesn't hurt, but it certainly doesn't hurt, but I don't even say the words cancel. I just immediately, which is the same effect, of course. I just replace it in my mind's eye or in my feeling center. If it's a thought that I'm feeling and I'm not picturing, I just shift the feeling immediately and decide to have a different feeling. If it's a thought that I'm picturing in my mind, I just change the picture, just like changing a television channel. I just move to a different thought about it, and I have an immediate different thought. I don't run from it, however, with great fear. I don't, in my own particular way, I don't just run away and say, oh, no, cancel, I didn't mean that, oh, my God, you know, I don't get into that, because that just empowers, in my own mind, that just adds more power to it. You know, what you resist persists. Conversations
right.
with God makes it very clear, what you resist persists. I just go, you know, oh, interesting thought, and let it go right. It comes in one ear and goes out the other, so to speak. And I just kind of like go, oh, that was an interesting thought. It's not the one that I choose as my permanent reality. What an interesting picture. Let's move on. And I just picture something else or feel a different way. It's interesting how you can change feelings. You know, thoughts are one thing, but feelings are really what empower and fuel the thoughts as creative devices. So what I've learned how to do is to shift my feeling in the instant moment by just changing how I choose to feel about whatever it is I'm thinking about.
Well, that just leads to the next question, which, when you're feeling down and out, what is the single most powerful thought that you have to shift you back? Okay, all right, welcome everybody. This is a special affiliates-only teleconference presented by the Spiritual Cinema Circle. My name is Arielle Ford, and today my very special guest is Neil Donald Walsh. Most of you know him as the best-selling author of the Conversations with God series, but those of you who don't know him, let me tell you just a little bit about his story. In 1992, his life was totally transformed when he fired off an angry letter to God, and he asked God, what does it take to make life work? And to his very great surprise, God answered. This dialogue lasted for over 3 years and became the internationally best-selling book series known as Conversations with God, which has spent years on the New York Times bestseller list. Now there is a movie based on his life. It's also called Conversations with God, and it's going to be our feature film in the February collection of the Spiritual Cinema Circle. I want to read you just a few of the glowing endorsements this film has received. Marianne Williamson says, this movie is a marvelous illustration of how a life can transform from something so seemingly hopeless to something miraculously good. Deepak Chopra said, it's an incredibly emotional journey. And my sister, Debbie Ford, said, it brilliantly and poignantly illustrates how life's greatest gifts could arise in our darkest hours. Some of you know that Neil is the host of his radio show on the Sirius satellite radio station Lime, but today we're going to turn the tables on him, and I'm going to get to interview him. So we'll start right now. Neil, welcome.
Thank you very much, Arielle. It's lovely to be here.
Well, we're very excited to have you. We have hundreds of people on the call, and they sent in lots and lots of questions. So I think we'll just get started. The one question that came up, 50% of the questions
yeah,
that came
well,
in
yeah,
was...
Yes, no, maybe, perhaps, and sometimes.
That's it. People want to know, how do you know that you're talking to God?
Well, I was having fun with you there, but... The answer to the question is, I think it has to do with the quality of the experience and also the information. And if I could qualify that just briefly, the experience is one that really, I don't want to sound fluffy or airy-fairy here, but it really does take over my whole body. That is, I have a physical experience of complete peace, utter serenity. Often I feel as though I'm near tears of joy. My eyes tend to water up, and I just feel, I guess, healthier than I have ever felt before. It's just a feeling of well-being, really extraordinary well-being. And that's a felt sense of wholeness that I can't describe in words other than those that I've used. And that's number one. So that feeling, that physical sensation, if you please, is what comes over me. It many people feel something like that when they're meditating or have other kinds of transcendent experiences. And then the second way that I believe myself to know is by the quality of the information itself that's coming through. Very often, words will appear on the paper in front of me or on the computer screen. I do much work by computer now, that I would never in a million years have said, never have thought of, or never have constructed in just that way. And by the way, I have these experiences not just when I'm writing my books, but often when I'm writing letters to someone, emails to people, my daily blog. It isn't just, oh, Neil's going to sit down now and write a section of his book or an article for his newsletter. But in fact, these kinds of transcendent moments occur. And the reason I brought that up is, Ariel, just the other day I was writing something for my blog. I have a daily blog, and I realized somewhere in the middle of this blog that I had really flown away almost, just gone to a different place, and the result was evident in the blog content itself. The comments that I received afterward from readers of the blog were, wow, you know, unbelievable stuff. And as I reread the blog a few days later, I myself saw that it was kind of like unbelievable stuff. It was entirely different in tone and nuance from the blogs before and after it when I was in a different space. And it was very clear to me that at that point I had gotten in touch with that transcendent part of all of us where I experienced what I have called my conversations with God. I hope that's a good answer. It's the only answer.
That's a great answer. I've never heard you actually describe it that way. So I know half the people out there are thinking, where can they find your blog?
Oh, well, it's just in an obvious place, actually. It would be at www.cwgblog.com. Pretty straightforward.
cwgblog.com. And that leads me right into the next question was, when you are hearing God's words, do they always appear perfectly without any need for editing?
Yes, yes. They do. If I try to get in there and edit it, I almost always mess it up. I am one of the few writers, actually, in publishing today, whose work is very, very rarely edited. I think the only kind of editing that's ever been done on my work is if there's a typo, my fingers just don't work right on the original manuscript, or if it's in my dialogue, that is words that I am saying. That I've had a syntax problem, or maybe I went on too long, and the editor might think that the question might better be phrased with a few less words. But in the dialogue that has come through me, in the voice of God, if you please, those words have never been edited. As a matter of fact, they tell a joke over at the very first publishing house that produced this material, and the joke was that the publisher himself went out to the editor's offices where all the editors sit in their little cubicles, and he said, you know, who would like to edit God? no one volunteered, and that was the end of that. So, in fact, the words that have appeared in the books are exactly as they came through the first time. The flow of the book itself is the way it came through me the first time. My books require very, very little editing, just for grammatical errors once in a while or typos that occur in my dialogue.
Oh, that's great. What is the next question you'd like to ask God?
They're very personal questions. I was going to say I kind of have stopped asking God questions of a universal nature. If I were to ask God a question today, it would be, what can I do next to become more of the person that I really want to be? What is it that I don't clearly understand yet about myself and about life that stops me from experiencing myself as the kind and warm and gentle, caring, loving person that I can be sometimes, but not all of the time? And what is blocking me from experiencing myself as that 24 hours a day? That would be. And then I guess the next question I'd ask is if there's a secret on how I can unload my feeling, the bad feelings I have about myself from time to time. What would that be? Those
and
are the questions.
Of course, you'd have to write another book because all of us want to know the answers to all of those questions.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the movie a little bit. What was it like to see your life portrayed on the big screen?
Well, you know, Ariel, it was surreal. It was very surreal, if surreal could be modified by the word very. Surreal itself is a pretty big word. It was just otherworldly. I don't think that there are seven people on the whole planet out of 6 billion who could walk into a movie theater tomorrow and see a motion picture of their life. It's just not something that happens very often to people. There probably aren't 150 in all of human history, and there probably aren't 7 or 10 people alive today who could have that experience. I'm not bragging about that. I just want people to understand it's beyond surreal. It goes past surreal, right straight to otherworldly, because there's, you know, I'm one in a billion people who've had that experience. And as I sat back in the theater and watched the movie, I realized that. It just struck me, my gosh, there are billions of people on this planet. There can't be 20 of us who could have this experience right now. And it was so strange, and I wept, you know, and I was moved, and I was touched by the emotion of what was going on. I got caught up, interestingly enough, in the film, just as a viewer would. But now, then something else interesting happened. I found myself, first of all, I began watching my own reactions to the movie. And I thought, isn't this strange? I know the story. I know what's going to happen next. Why am I being so touched by this? And then I watched myself watching the other people in the theater as they reacted, and I watched my own reaction to their reaction. And then I had a third level experience, which was when I got up, and as we did the tour, we took the movie on tour for several weeks back in the fall to audiences around the country, and I watched myself as people asked me questions about the movie and talked to me about it, almost as if I was a third person, almost as if the story was about someone else. And so it's very, very strange, Ariel. I don't imagine I'll ever have an experience like this again, you know, for the rest of my life. Most unusual and very difficult to describe.
And I know a lot of people want to know, how true did the film stay to your story?
Very, very, very true. We would not allow. I want to say something here. The production company, the Spiritual Cinema Circle, which produced this film, the producer and director in person, in the person of Stephen Simon, and as well as the scriptwriter, Eric Delabar, allowed me complete and total freedom. One would almost use the word power. That is, I had the power to delete, to say no to anything that was in the script. There were a couple of places where Eric, as a good screenwriter, did what movie people do sometimes, and kind of like, I don't want to say exaggerated, but embellished an experience or two or a line here and there. I'll give you a typical example. One typical example. There's a scene in the movie where I lay down a tip for a waitress in a restaurant, and he had me put down in the film a $500 bill or five $100 bills. And he just did that. He just kind of embellished a little bit what happened. The truth is, I think I laid down about $100 or so, $250s as I recall, or maybe $350s, for a young college girl who I felt, you know, just told me a story, and I was touched deeply by her, and I happened to have the cash on me, and just on a whim, I did that. But he had it in the film, in the script, as $500, and I just called him and I said, Eric, I called Steven and said, we can't do that. Oh, he said, it's going to be so dramatic, it's going to be so wonderful. I said, Eric, it didn't happen that way. I'm sorry, it just didn't happen, and we're not going to do that. We're not going to show me in a way that's not true. I've never given anybody a $500 tip for a cup of coffee. This was in a coffee shop in my life. I said, you know, let it be what it was. I gave her three $50 bills And that was, let it be what it was. Well, you know what? I watched the scene in the theater a million times now. I've seen the movie many times in front of audiences. And when they see the 350s go down, they're gasping that, you know, that on a whim someone would do that. It didn't have to be. The point is, it didn't have to be any more exaggerated than what actually happened in real life. And that's just a small example of how the film was made. There's nothing in that film that I allow to be exaggerated because the story is, you know, strange enough, just the way it is.
And, you know, I've known you since, what, 1994, when the first edition came out, and I know along the way there have been other people who wanted to make this movie. You know, why Stephen Simon?
Well, because I trusted him, for the very reason I've just described. Stephen Simon is a person that I completely trust, artistically, philosophically, spiritually. Every Lee that there is how I trust him. And I knew that he and the company behind him, not to throw bouquets where they might obviously be thrown, but it's just simply true, Gay Hendricks and the other folks who are involved in the spiritual cinema circle gave me their word. And I know them personally. These are people that I've known personally. And they gave me their word that there would be no violation of the spiritual content, no exaggeration of the facts of the matter, and that I would have complete and total artistic input and control over the project. And I believe that, although I didn't really need to exercise control very often. I can't think of four instances in the entire movie where I had to make a phone call and say, could we not do this, could we not do that. Because we told the story very directly, and Stephen Simon was committed to producing on film an accurate and non-exaggerated, non-Hollywoodized version of my life, which is exactly what he did.
Great. So for those of you on the line that haven't seen the movie yet, and I'm so excited you're going to see it in February, it really deals with Neil's true story of the time when he was homeless with a broken neck, living in a park, dumpster diving for tin cans to cash in for money to eat. Neil, how did you become homeless?
Well, I broke my neck in an automobile accident, and I couldn't work as a result of that, and I was out of work, and I couldn't. And then, as my neck began to partly heal, but I still had to wear, because I had to wear a what's known as a Philadelphia collar, which kept my head up because my neck could not support the weight of my head. By the way, I must say I was very lucky. I mean, people who break their neck very, very often die or become paralyzed in some way or another, if not completely paralyzed from the neck down. It's just remarkable that I did neither. And I do have some range of motion difficulties with my neck to this day, but certainly nothing that would be anything more than a small annoyance. So I got out of that unscathed, but it took about a year and a half or two to heal from that broken neck. And during that time, I was wearing this collar, which supported the weight of my head, because my neck, of course, could not do so until it was totally healed and fused again. And so I was out of work, and I couldn't get work. I mean, I went everywhere to try to find work, and it was just not possible to do, and I finally just ran out of money. And I fell through the cracks in the safety net that is our system in our society, and there was no support for me, and I couldn't find work anywhere. I was really willing at that point to do almost anything, but I no one would hire me. And the film vividly depicts that. I walked the streets, really, and just begged even store owners, could I just clean the shelves or mop the floors or some light work that won't hurt my neck? I mean, be a cashier, anything, I'll do anything. And no one wanted to take a chance on me because they saw that collar around my neck, and they just weren't about to hire a person who was walking around with that kind of contraption on him, for obvious reasons, insurance reasons, and so the slightest move and they could be in trouble. So
right.
I wound up on the street because I, you know, there was nowhere else to go. I ran out of money and no one would take me in, and that was the end of that story.
So did God ever tell you specifically how to change your situation from homelessness to where you are now?
No, not specifically. Nobody said, you know, what you need to do is, you know, take the following four steps. No, advice was far more general, or the insight was far more general. You can be what you wish to be. You can do what you would choose to do. Don't worry about making a living, worry about making a life. The kinds of freeing, actually the truth is freeing statements, I was going to say, the kinds of statements that free you up from your preconceived notions of life and how it works. The actual fact of the matter is that I did not have my conversation with God until I got off the street. Uh-huh. I got off the street before I had the conversation. It wasn't like, oh, this extraordinary experience, and then I wound up leaving the street. It was the other way around. I left the street, pulled myself up, if you please, by my own bootstraps, and then I hit the basement, because I got back into real life, got a regular job. I wasn't making a lot of money, but enough to survive, enough to be off the street, and then I really hit rock bottom, because I realized, my gosh, life really is empty. It really is shallow. It is offering me nothing here. And at that point, I just didn't know where to turn mentally. I thought, what is the point? And I was really kind of desperate. And, you know, what does it take to make life work was the question that was plaguing my soul. And that's when I had my conversation with God, after I got back off the street and was into the mainstream once again.
One of our listeners wrote in and wants to ask you, he says, as a person who was homeless as a youngster, one of my greatest fears is to be homeless again. Now that I believe in the law of attraction, won't my fear tend to manifest me being homeless again? How can I correct that?
Well, not unless you dwell on it. I think the universe, you know, Mother Nature knows what's going on. I mean, the universe is really clear what you want and what you don't want. And if a fear just happens to fly through you, even if it does it once a week or something, but if you keep on just rejecting when it comes up, just rejecting it, just say to yourself, in a sense, no, I don't choose that. I don't want that. Thank you very much for showing me the opposite, but that's not what I choose. And then begin to rearrange your thoughts. Just think of something else and change your mind around that. Every time that thought and that fear comes up, and it will come up, because it's like trying to not think of the pink elephant in the living room. Of course you will, especially if you've had that experience in your life. I, too, have had nights or moments when I've rolled around or walked down the street and thought of, oh, my gosh, you know, what would happen if I wind up back there again? And on the street. But I, when I have those kinds of thoughts, I just kind of brush them aside. Thank you very much for showing me that, and choose again. And I think that the fact that I just had the thought is not what creates my reality. But if I dwell in it, if I have it over and over again, if I go there deliberately and with intention, see, here's what I want to say to that person. It's intentioned thought as opposed to a passing thought. It's intentioned thought, not even a fear, because fear is not an intentioned thought. The difference between fear and creative thought is that fear does not have the power of intention behind it. I want to say that again, because that's very important. The difference between fear and a creative thought is that fear does not have intention behind it. If you intend what you are fearing, you'll increase the power of your thought by 100 times, and you're very liable to draw that to you. But if you just have a passing, fearful thought, hey, don't worry about that. Otherwise, you'll be afraid to think anything, and you'll just paralyze yourself mentally. Can't be done that way. Trust God. God knows what it is you really want, and God's not going to say, oh, he had a thought at 4 o'clock Saturday afternoon. We're going to give him that.
That's such a great distinction. So I see sometimes when I have what I call negative thoughts, I'll immediately say to myself, cancel, cancel. Do you think that's a good idea?
It doesn't hurt, but it certainly doesn't hurt, but I don't even say the words cancel. I just immediately, which is the same effect, of course. I just replace it in my mind's eye or in my feeling center. If it's a thought that I'm feeling and I'm not picturing, I just shift the feeling immediately and decide to have a different feeling. If it's a thought that I'm picturing in my mind, I just change the picture, just like changing a television channel. I just move to a different thought about it, and I have an immediate different thought. I don't run from it, however, with great fear. I don't, in my own particular way, I don't just run away and say, oh, no, cancel, I didn't mean that, oh, my God, you know, I don't get into that, because that just empowers, in my own mind, that just adds more power to it. You know, what you resist persists. Conversations
right.
with God makes it very clear, what you resist persists. I just go, you know, oh, interesting thought, and let it go right. It comes in one ear and goes out the other, so to speak. And I just kind of like go, oh, that was an interesting thought. It's not the one that I choose as my permanent reality. What an interesting picture. Let's move on. And I just picture something else or feel a different way. It's interesting how you can change feelings. You know, thoughts are one thing, but feelings are really what empower and fuel the thoughts as creative devices. So what I've learned how to do is to shift my feeling in the instant moment by just changing how I choose to feel about whatever it is I'm thinking about.
Well, that just leads to the next question, which, when you're feeling down and out, what is the single most powerful thought that you have to shift you back?
Well, this is going to sound very airy-fairy. You know, I, I, uh, I don't want to sound like a loopy guy here, but I do think of God when I'm feeling down and out, and we all have those moments, and I have them like anybody else. I just stop whatever I'm doing. If I'm walking outside or doing the dishes or lying in bed or writing, whatever I'm doing, I just put down the pen or walk away from what I'm doing and just stop. And I try to just find a little place. I don't want to be indelicate here, but sometimes I just go to the washroom, to the restroom, where I can be alone, close the door, sit on the closed toilet, just sit there on the seat and just be by myself, because sometimes it's the only place I can be alone for 20 seconds. And I just sit there, or I find some other place I can be by myself, take a walk outside where I can be by myself, and I just think of God. And I just say, thank you, God. Thank you, God, for this wonderful life. That if it were to end this minute, right here, right now, I've had enough wonder, enough joy, enough love, enough celebration, enough of the extraordinary glory of who you are, moving through me, as me, and through everyone else in my life. Thank you for the beauty of these flowers, of this road, of this snow outside, of this life itself. Just thank you, God. And whatever I see right now that is unsettling me, let me see past that to the truth and the wonder of all of it. No, Ariel, I can't even say those words. You're asking me very personal questions here. This is a very personal process that I go through, and when I go through it, it changes my experience utterly.
I can hear that. And, you know, that's not an airy-fairy answer. On Friday night, we went to the opening event of the Scripps Integrative Medicine Annual Conference, and the doctor who's the founder of this, you know, very well-respected institute, was introducing Larry Dossey. But in the process of introducing him, she shared this story, which she said she had never spoken of publicly before, where just a few years ago, she was in the operating room. She's a cardiologist, and she was about to do a very difficult and precise surgery, and she didn't know if she could do it. She didn't know if the patient would live or die. And she turned and she prayed and she asked God to guide her and help her. And she realized that she was finally in a room full of 1,000 people in which she could share the story that she prayed in an operating room and not be laughed at.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not airy-fairy. I think it's getting a little bit safer to, you know, share these kinds of stories. And I'm grateful to you for opening up the way that you do. It's always amazing to talk to you. So, during times of difficulties, when you do feel like giving up, you know what?
Well, I never have those feelings anymore.
You don't, never.
You ask a question that I can't answer because I have.
Okay, all right. So
I
have, we'll
the honest truth is, I haven't gone to a place where I feel like giving up in the past 15 years.
Good, awesome. So, what is the most important thing people can do to experience deep happiness and fulfillment?
Give deep happiness and fulfillment to another, to the next person you meet on the street. What you choose to experience for yourself, be the source of it in the life of another. Whatever I want to experience, deep happiness, serenity, peace, security, humor, compassion, patience, understanding, whatever it is that I want to experience, if I will just simply turn it around and be the source of that experience in the life of another, and by the way, I won't have any difficulty finding others who want that experience right here, right now, just walk down the street, get on the phone, or for that matter, pick up the telephone, because the phone will almost always ring within 10 minutes of one of those experiences in my life. And so whenever I'm feeling that I want to experience something, I just look for someone else who wants to experience that. And I see what it would take for me to be the source of that experience in the life of another, because you see, the moment that I choose to be the source of that experience in someone else's life, that's the moment that I realize, that is, make real, I realize that I already have that experience within me, or I couldn't possibly supply it to another.
Mm. That is just so amazing. So it's like that line from Course in Miracles, the only thing that can be lacking is what I'm not giving. Or
that's exactly right.
Is that how it goes?
Well, it's close enough, and it captures the meaning of exactly what I said. The only thing I'm lacking is what I'm not giving.
I love that. What messages about the homeless would you like people to come away from this movie with?
Well, I think the obvious one is that don't judge them. I mean, I experienced the judgment of people who looked at me and assumed that I was helpless, worthless, and hopeless, and didn't want to have anything to do with me. wouldn't even give me a quarter or a dime, you know, or the time of day for that matter. Literally, one person would not tell me what time it was. I remember he just brushed right past me as if I had asked him for all of his worldly wealth, and all he asked him was, do you have the time? So I've experienced that extraordinary level of judgment that people have when you're not looking as well as you'd like, when your hair hasn't been washed in 4 weeks, when you're wearing scruffy clothes, and you've been out on the street, living on the street. And so judge not, and neither condemn, would be my advice, because you never know who might become your next New York Times best-selling author.
So true. During the making of the movie, is there one particular moment of beauty that you recall, even in the early, I know you weren't on set most of the time, but during the script process and all the different meetings you were in, is there one moment that you really recall as a special pivotal moment for you?
Well, there were two, actually. One was in a scripting conference with Stephen and Eric Delabar and our wonderful script consultant, Vicky King, and myself, the four of us, and I think Joao Fernandez, our just our glorious cinematographer, was there. And the five of us were sitting around the table discussing a particular plot element. And Vicky King looked me, leaned across the conference table. We were sitting around for a moment and just looked me straight in the eye, and she said, why don't you tell me the truth about your mother? And I don't know where she came up with that or why that came out of her, but it was, you know, Vicky King is a very spiritual person, a very intuitive person. And we had been talking about my past and my childhood and so forth, but I never mentioned a word about Mom. And she just asked me that, and I sat there stunned, and I said, what did you want to know? She said, why don't you start with everything? And so I did. Out of, you know, it turned into what, you know, if I hadn't been in the room myself, I would have sworn I had stepped into a therapy session, because I began just telling her all about my relationship with my mother, which was very wonderful, by the way, but I had a wonderful childhood. But she did have one incident in my life that I never even imagined would make its way into the movie, that they hadn't even thought about it. But it was, my mom said to me once when she was doing some amateur palm reading, she just looked at me and she said, you know, you're a lifeline and your heart line and you're this line and you're that line. And she said, you'll never love anybody. And I said, what? She said, and I was about 7 or 8. I was a very young person. She said, well, you know, honey, your lines say that you'll never love anybody. You'll never fall in love with anybody. And she just thought of it as a lighthearted, you know, thing. But Vicky leaned back in her chair at that point. The room was stunned, of course, and said nothing. She just glanced very quietly over at Stephen Simon, who was sitting to her left. And Stephen looked at me, the director and producer, and said, you realize, of course, that the entire movie pivots on that very plot point. You understand you've just given us the key to this whole film. And I said, no, I don't understand any such thing. He said, well, you got to know what you've just said there. And we've got to find a way to show that in the movie. And we've got to find a way to make people understand that that had so much to do with all that happened to you in your life, particularly around your relationships with women, that produced some of the outcomes that we're going to put on this on film. Second extraordinary movie, and of course, all of our hearts stopped, and I almost wept. And I think it did weep just briefly. I just thought, my God, you know, what's going on here? You know, and I realized that this movie was going to be very deeply probing. I'm not going to say invasive because it wasn't invasive, but it was very deeply probing to the depth of all the experiences I've had in my life, including that moment when my mother said that to me at the age of 7 or 8. The second moment that I remember vividly was walking the set that they had created, which was astonishingly realistic, of the park where I had a tent and where I camped out for almost a year out in the weather, in the rain and the cold and so forth. And they had recreated this park out of my description of it. We also went down to the actual site where the park still exists. And the set people, set decorators and so forth, it was just unbelievable how realistic that place was. And when I walked that set, I immediately felt all the feelings that I felt when I lived in the place very much like that in real life, as you can imagine. And they even had a tent, which was very similar to the tent that I slept in. I mean, it was very, talk about surreal, it was like stepping into a reenactment of your own past. Mm. And it was you know, and I mean a real reenactment, not a bunch of kids on stage play acting. I'm talking about right down to the spoons in the kettles. You know, everything was just perfectly, the set decorators had gone to no end. As you know, on movie sets, everything is very realistic, even things that will never be seen by a camera. I asked about that. I said, why is this all so realistic? No one will ever see it, because, let me give you an example. They had a wooden spoon that they went out and bought at a local store, just a wooden spoon. And then they tortured it, what they call torture the spoon. They burned it with matches, and they chipped it off and made it look like it had been there for 120 years. And the spoon was inside of a kettle, on the pot, on the stove, in the scene that would never be seen. I said to the set decorator, why did you spend, how much time did it take you to torture this spoon to make it look like it was 20 years old? And she said, oh, about an hour or so. I said, why would you spend that kind of a time on one wooden spoon that'll never be seen on camera? She said, you don't understand. The camera may not see it, but the actor will. Mm-hmm. And as soon as the actor looks at that spoon, if that spoon is not looking like it has to look, like it was there for 20 years, it pulls the actor right out of the moment.
You know, that explains everything. I have a picture of you with that spoon, which was sent to me when the film was in production. And I kept wondering, why did they send me this picture of Neil with a spoon? You know, now I finally have some context for it. I want to take just 30 seconds here to mention some of the things that Neil has coming up, if some of you can't stay on for the whole hour. He's going to be doing a couple of tours in the spring, a Western Canadian tour and a worldwide tour for Humanity's team. And there are a couple of different websites I'd like you to take a look at when you have time. One is eldertreeevents.com, elder, E-L-D-E-R, treeevents.com. Another one is humanitiesteam.com, which we'll ask Neil about in just a moment. And the last one is schoolofthenewspirituality.com, schoolofthenewspirituality.com. And, Neil, tell us briefly what that is, because that's new to me as well.
It's a movement that I've created, a global movement, to bring teachings of the new spirituality to children all over the world. The one thing that I've heard at my lectures and retreats and seminars for the past 12 years, wherever I go, and I've given them now in most of the countries of the world, people will say to me in every culture, "Why, if only there was a school system or even a classroom or even a homeschooling program, something for our young people, that we wouldn't have to worry, because there's nothing like this exists, and I don't know how to teach this to my children, what I've learned in all of these conversations with God books and the other books of the new spirituality, books by Deepak Chopra and Wayne Dyer and Gary Zukav and all the rest of the wonderful teachers, Marianne Williamson and Eckhart Tolle and all the rest. If only someone would develop an actual curriculum for 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. I mean, and I said, you know what, after hearing that for years, we're going to do it. So I went about the business of that. I pulled together some top educators and some top educational consultants from around the world, people like Dr. Bruce Chilton, who's the director of comparative theology at Bard College, Matthew Fox, Reverend Matthew Fox, and others who have one foot in both worlds. They have one foot deeply entrenched in academia, another foot deeply entrenched in theology, religion, and spirituality. And I said, guys, if we were going to develop a program for 6-year-olds, 8-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, what would it look like, and how can we put that on the ground? And they began to work with me on that, and that work is not finished yet. We're just really beginning. We're creating everything from a grade school to a high school, right up straight to the university. We are offering some classes through the University of the New Spirituality this fall for adults who want to take adult education courses in the new spirituality, toward the end that we might ultimately change the cultural story that informs humanity about itself. Because life is a process that informs life about life through the process of life itself, and the story we've been telling ourselves about each other and about life has been a lie. It's been false. It's been incredibly inaccurate and wildly incomplete. It's time for a new cultural story to emerge on this planet, and the only way that's going to happen is through the creation of a school. So we've created that, and we will hopefully have it on the ground. In fact, the first one is already open in Atlanta, Georgia. We hope to have other schools. They're just small classrooms. I don't want to give people the impression that I'm talking about a two-story building with 58 rooms. It's just a small, tiny classroom in Atlanta. It's a start, however. It's a start. It's a place where the parents of Atlanta can bring their 9, 10, and 12-year-olds into a room and hear an entire curriculum in the new spirituality, so that when those students, when those children are 18, 19, 20, and 25, they can bring to the world a new idea about life itself, about who they are, and about how we can all live together with each other. That's what it takes, and that's what we're going to do.
Okay, so that website again is schoolofthenewspirituality.com. What do you think is the single most important word in the English language?
Yes.
Yes. I would agree with you on that. And what would that,
And because that's the only word that God has in her vocabulary. See, God only says yes, and all we have to do to begin to change the entire experience of life on this planet is just say yes to each other.
And the same person asks, what is your single biggest accomplishment in this life?
Wow, I don't think of my life as having a lot of big accomplishments, a lot of dinky small ones, but I guess the biggest of the small would be maybe beginning to overcome, just beginning to overcome my fear of telling the truth, my habitual cruelty to other people in small and but consistent ways. Just the first steps in overcoming that would be my biggest accomplishment. If I can achieve just a little bit in that, that when I am older or when I die, someone stands up someplace and says, well, you know, he was tough. He was tough to be around. He was difficult. He was hard to handle. He was cruel to many people, but by golly, toward the end, he really tried.
So if you had it to do all over again, what would you do differently?
Tell the truth as soon as I knew it.
And I know you do a lot of that now, because we've talked about this. And for the people out there that aren't really getting this part of the conversation or are afraid to tell and be radically honest, how would you advise them?
Tell the truth as soon as you know it. Speak your truth, but soothe your words with peace. There's a way to do that, but speak your truth as soon as you know it. On any subject, what do you want for dinner? Do you really want to see that movie? How's our relationship going? Was it as good for you as it was for me? Do you want to buy that car? Is this truly the city you want to live in? Are you really enjoying your job? How do you feel today? Whatever the question is, whatever the consideration, whatever the concern, whatever the experience you're having and moving through, tell the truth as soon as you know it. That's the advice I would give to everyone, because I've experienced in my own life and I've observed in the lives of others that often we withhold the truth. We are on withhold, what I call we're on withhold. We just simply withhold the truth. We don't want to hurt someone's feelings, or more often we don't want to reveal ourselves. We don't want anyone to know what we're really thinking and feeling because we're afraid of what we're going to lose in the process. So we kind of hold 80% of the data in, and I've learned that that's what's been my downfall, because ultimately, the truth does come out. I mean, I hate to be so pedantic and predictable here, but in fact, it is true that ultimately the truth will come out. And then you'll wonder, and then it almost always comes out in ways that are twice as hurtful, twice as harmful, and twice as damaging to yourself and everyone else as it would have been if you had just said it as soon as you knew it. So I've learned to cut myself off at the pass. I've learned to just say, right as soon as I know it, you know what, thank you very much, but I don't prefer this particular dish. I could just pass on the asparagus. I would really appreciate it.
You know, a few years ago we had a conversation, and I don't remember the context, but I wrote this down when you said it to me, and it was something about asking yourself before you speak, is it true, is it necessary, and there was a third part to it that I can't remember
Is it helpful?
Is it helpful, right.
Is it true, is it necessary, is it helpful?
And
if it doesn't meet the test of three, shut the hell up.
Is it true? Is it necessary? Is it helpful? Good things to remember. Well, one of our listeners says he's going to be working at the William Morris Agency starting in September. His main intention for working there is to help spiritual cinema, such as Conversations with God, get to a larger mainstream audience. Do you have any advice for him?
Do it. And hurry up.
That's a good one. Someone else wants to know, are you coming to the UK?
Yes, I'm there all the time. I'll be there again, I think, this spring. I'm not sure. I believe I'll be there this spring. I know I'll be there in October in Bristol or perhaps in London. I'm not sure which of the cities now. I was there in Bristol last year. But I'm in the UK all the time. I'm there probably at least once a year, often two or three times a year. The same with France. I'm in Paris frequently, probably two or three times a year. So, yes, I'll be back in the UK. I know I'm there for a five-day retreat in October, and I may be there before then. My calendar shows everything, however. My calendar is quite public.
And what's the best website to see your calendar?
Well, I could go to neildonaldwalsh.com, you have to spell my name right because the internet is very unforgiving, but it would be N-E-A-L-E, Donald, and then W-A-L-S-C-H, neildonaldwalsh.com. They should be able to find my calendar right there.
Okay. If you had to recommend just one of your titles to read, which one would it be?
Excuse me, if I had what?
If you could only recommend one of your books to somebody, which one would it be?
Home with God, In a Life That Never
Home
Ends.
With God.
The last one. Not because it's the last one, because it is by far the most comprehensive book about life, death, life hereafter, the whole experience of what we're doing here and why, who we are and how it all works. It has been called by others, not by me, the most profound of all the Conversations with God books, and I believe that to be true.
Another one of our listeners says, I know many spiritual people who are on the verge of stepping into their power and sharing their message with the world, but are reluctant about becoming famous. What suggestions could you give to them during the conscious creation of their destiny for those who don't want to be famous, but do want to get a message out?
Are you worried about you, or are you worried about everybody else? If you're worried about you, forget the message. Throw it away, because you've missed the point of the message itself. The point of the message is that life isn't about you. It's about everyone else whose life you touch. And if you're worried about being famous, then you have your focus in precisely the wrong place. So what if you become famous? I mean, so what? Well, why wouldn't you want to use that tool? Because fame is a great tool, even limited fame, even as a big fish in a small pond. I'm not a famous person, but I guess in the so-called New Age movement, in the New Thought community, within certain spiritual circles, perhaps I'm more widely known than a few other people. That might be true. But it's a wonderful tool. It's a tremendous device. God is just handing you creative tools that you can use for the greater benefit of every human being whose life you touch, and therefore, of course, for your own growth and benefit as well. Why anyone would shy away from that, I don't know. But if you do really need to shy away from it, then, you know, then do so. then just go sit quietly in your house and pull the shades and lock the door. But as soon as you walk out of your house, you're going to be famous to someone because of how it is, how you act, how you are. If you think you're not known in your own circle of friends, if you think you're not known in your own community, it's not a question of whether you're famous, just a question of how famous you're going to be.
Right. What would you say God would most like us to remember about ourselves?
Who we really are, and who everyone else is, but who we really are. And I'll amend that to say this as well. I think my first thought would be, what would God like us most to remember about ourselves or to know about ourselves? That we are forgiven. In fact, that forgiveness is not even necessary. And so that we can hold ourselves again in the magnificent purity and innocence of our childhood, to be able to look at our own picture, our own picture of ourselves at 6, 7, and 8, when we were so full of life, so full of hope, so full of innocence, so without bile, so nothing going on. Just look at that 6 or 7 or 8-year-old face in that snapshot and be able to look at that and say, that's me right now today. That's who I am, equally without bile, equally without offense, equally without any black energy at all. And all that I think I need to be forgiven for, I am forgiven for, because forgiveness is not even necessary. Let us then walk on in the light and in the wonder and the glory of our true identity. And then let us see everyone else whose life we touch in exactly the same way. And if this doesn't turn out to be a better day, I would be very, very, very surprised.
You know, forgiveness is such a big topic, especially right now with the world situation and how it is and all the polarization. Can you talk a little bit more about forgiveness, not just, you know, one-on-one, but the bigger picture?
Well, you know, forgiveness is another word for remembering. And this is what I was saying in my blog. You know, we talked about an hour ago about this. I was writing on my blog the other day about forgiveness, out of the blue, just happened to think that might be an interesting topic to write about. And somewhere, about 4 sentences into it, I clicked into another level of connection with the divine. And I began writing, and I wrote something that I never wrote before in my whole life. I just, in all the books, I just wrote, all of a sudden out came the sentence, forgiveness is another word for remembering. And I realized that no one had ever put it quite that way, not even me, in my own books. Or if it is put that way somewhere else, I've never seen it. So I explored that further, verbally. And what came through me was what forgiveness is another way of describing the act of remembering who we really are and who everyone else is. Because in the instant moment, in the moment of your instant remembering, there is a thought that permeates our being, that washes away any prior idea that that person that we have remembered could have done anything damaging, hurtful, or what we would call wrong. We then begin to see the perfection. We remember who we are. We remember the perfection of everything exactly as it's happening. We simply remember, that is, we put ourselves back together again. We become a member once again of the body of God. So I realized then that remembering is just the act of forgiving, and forgiving is the act of remembering that the two are one. As it relates to the whole world, I remember then who, we'll just use an example, let's not use names, certain people in the world who appear to be doing things that are damaging or hurtful to others, and for them, for that matter, to themselves, and who appear to be dangerous to all of us. I remember who they really are. And in that instant remembering of that, I also come to an extraordinary awareness that they do not remember themselves. That the only thing wrong with them, so to speak, the only thing that's not working, the only thing that causes them to act as if they act in the way that they do, is the fact that they do not remember who they are. So I first seek to remember everyone, and then I seek to send them in whatever way I can the energies of remembrance, that they might one day perhaps wake up with the sunrise and go, oh my golly, oh my gosh, I see now who I really am, and I am absolved, and I'm free.
And I want to remind everybody, you can find Neil's blog at cwgblog.com. So Neil, is talking to God the same as talking to your spirit guides?
Yes, there's no difference. Arose by any other name. By the way, talking to you is like talking to God. There's no difference between that either. That's what I'm talking about. When you remember that, then everyday conversations, everyday interactions with your environment, with those flowers that you do see as you're walking down the path, with the snow out there on the driveway, with the air, with everything, with life itself, is remarkably different and extraordinarily enhanced and incredibly glorious. I find that the older I get, the more I'm aware of the wonder of each moment, almost each breath. And so the answer to your question is yes, talking to spirit guides, in my experience, is exactly the same as talking to God, because there's no separation between them, that spirit guides are simply an individuation, if you please, of the eternal essence, of the glorious essence of the all that we call God in some languages, and so too is it when I talk with you.
Mm.
The only question will be not do I know that I'm talking to the goddess when I talk to you, but do you know it as well? If both of us know it at the same time, we have an extraordinary exchange of energies. It's called making love, and it can be done over the telephone.
I always feel good when I talk to you, Neil, I have to say. Are you happier today, or this is not my question, this is one of the listeners. Are you happier today, or do you still struggle with the same issues with the ladies?
Yes to both questions.
Okay.
The answer is yes and yes. I think that I will always struggle all of my life, not just with the ladies, but with life itself. Because I'm determined to just move as deeply as I can to the richest experience that life has to offer for me. That is an experience of my own self, is what I mean by that. Not the most money or the most fame or the most glory, but when I say the richest experience that life has to offer, I mean the richest experience of my true self. And so no matter how happy I am, and I'm very happy these days and times, very, very happy as an individual, I nevertheless move into my very next encounter, for instance, my next conversation with Ariel Ford. If there was a way to make this even better, even more glorious, even more wonderful, what would that way be? How could I do that? How could I give more, receive more, experience more in this interaction that we're having? What would that look like? And that is a struggle in a way. It's what the true Islamicists call jihad. Jihad was never meant to indicate an outer battle with swords that attack other people. Jihad is understood by true members of the Islamic faith as the battle, the struggle within. The constant internal struggle, if you please, between the one side of us and the other side of us, finding that deep point of balance that allows us to use each moment of life as a golden opportunity to express and experience, to announce and declare, to become and fulfill who we really are.
Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left. Is there anything you want to share with this audience about the movie? They're all going to get to see it in February. As you know, this call was something special we did for the affiliates only. So many of our members come to us through our affiliates, and we're really excited that we have Conversations with God in February. What about this movie would you like to share with them?
Well, I think it's a wonderful depiction of a wonderful message. I would like to share with them that it is not my story so much, although it's, of course, woven around my experience because it has to have some point of focus. But it's not so much my story as it is, I hope, will be seen as the story of every man, of James Thurber's every man. That is, every human being on the earth, I hope, will be seen up there on that screen. And that what I hope people will come away from the movie with is, oh, I see, this can happen to anyone. And is, in fact, is happening to everyone, every moment, all the time. And if people walk away from that, from the movie with that understanding and that awareness, then we will have done exactly what we set out to do. And I do believe people do walk away with that. As I said, we've seen it in front of test audiences, and we've traveled with the movie now around the country, and people do walk away with that experience. So I would say then, if you want an experience of how it's possible for you and those you love and everyone that you know to have a direct experience of connection with the divine, then you'll want to watch this motion picture just to see how it happened in the experience of one human being, and to notice then how easy it is for even someone like all of us to have that experience. And I want people to understand you don't have to be a saint, obviously. You don't have to be saintly. You don't have to be a walking master. You don't have to be someone who sits in silence for 6 hours in the morning and 6 hours at night, or doing anything in particularly ordinary, extraordinary or special. You don't have to do anything other than just be the wonderful person that you are. And God will come to you, and that's the whole point of the movie, and bring you extraordinary insight and deep wisdom. If they walk away with that, if that's what people are looking for, how that happens in the life of one person, I think they'll enjoy this motion picture.
Well, thank you, Neil. Thanks so much for spending this hour with us. Before I let you go and let everyone say goodbye to you, I want to remind them that if you sign into the website, there is email copy. Don't send your blast out till February 1st. And check out Neil's website, cwgblog.com, eldertreeevents.com, humanitiesteam.com, and his newest project, schoolofthenewspirituality.com. So, Neil, thank you very much. Mike, if you can unmute everybody and let everyone say goodbye, I'll say goodbye, and thanks for joining us.
Bye, Neil.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Neil.
We appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Neil, thank you.
Thank you.
Good night, Neil. Goodbye.
Good night, everyone. Thank you.